What the Health with Gabby Allen on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, 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 lovely people. Good morning. And what a gorgeous morning. Well, it was today. I think it's about to rain. But I hope you've all had a glorious start to your day. And thank you for joining me now for my show, What the Health, on FUBAR Radio. We have a very exciting show today, including a talk with Charlotte Henshaw, three-time Paralympic champion who won two gold medals at this year's Paris Olympics. How amazing. So make sure you stick around for that. And if you've joined us before on a Tuesday morning, you will know that on this show, we talk about all things health, wellness and fitness. From each and every angle, we look to pick apart the latest trends that we see on social media and get expert opinions to separate myths from facts. So to do just that, right now, joining me is the lovely Naveen Cavale, plastic and cosmetic surgeon at The Real Plastic Surgery. And we're going to be discussing baby Botox. Hello, my love. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks so much for coming in. So, you are the director of The Real Plastic Surgery.
Yes, correct.
Where is that? Battersea?
So that's Battersea. So yeah, we've got our own clinic there, The Real Clinic in Battersea, just by the power station. We don't just do Botox. We do full-on surgery and everything. So you can follow me. I'll plug my Instagram whilst I'm here.
Yeah.
Real Plastics. I know we're here to talk about Botox.
Baby Botox, yeah.
Cool.
But you are literally around the corner from me, which
yes.
I don't know whether that's a good thing. I'll be like, listen, Nav, I'm coming in. What can you do for me today? So, talk to me now. What is baby Botox and how does it differ from the traditional Botox that we see?
Baby Botox it's basically Botox, but the idea is, and I'll come on to, I'm not the biggest fan, so we can talk about in a minute. Or you have, like everything, you've got to be really careful if you're going to do it. Baby Botox is basically small doses. And it tends to be sort of sold a bit as preventative. Mm. So therefore, it tends to be kind of sold to younger people, which is what I worry about.
Okay.
So I think, you know, in theory, yeah, if you never frown, if you never smile, if you never move your face, then you probably won't get what's called animation wrinkles, animation lines. You know, we all get sun damage lines, we get gravity as we age, everything goes south and we get, you know,
unfortunately.
That life, you know, is going to do its thing.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you know, we've got to move our faces and we've got to express
how do we? I don't like moving my face.
No, I'd like to, you know, I need to see how you're, you know, what you're, are you happy?
Don't look too closely.
And no, you look good. And
thanks.
But I also want to be able to tell whether you're happy, sad, worried, etc. So the idea of baby Botox mostly is to try and prevent, you know, lines in the future. And the trouble is, it doesn't necessarily, like everything in life, come without a price.
Mm.
So our faces are in balance. So you've got muscles that, say, lift your brow. You've got muscles that lower your brow. You know, you've got muscles that open your eyes, close your eyes, same thing with your mouth, and so on. If you, say, use baby Botox to your forehead to try and prevent forehead lines, you're paralyzing the muscle that lifts your eyebrows.
Yeah.
And you're not
drop them,
and you're not paralyzing the muscles that that lower your eyebrows. Mm. So that's probably the simplest example to use. And as a result, and I'm an old man. Okay, I'm in my 50s.
No, you're not.
I am. Yeah,
that's
old. but I have what's called brow descent. I've never had Botox, but I have age-related brow descent. My eyebrows now sit lower than they used to be, so my eyelids are less visible. So if I was a woman, I wouldn't have enough space to put
your shadow,
my eyeshadow on, and if you were to have baby Botox early on, that would happen a lot quicker.
Oh.
Okay, so, and that's great for someone like me because I'm a plastic surgeon. You can pay me loads of money to do a facelift later in life.
Yeah.
But do you really want to be doing that? Do you want to set yourself up? Not everyone ends up needing a facelift or wanting one. But if you do a lot of Botox early on, you might be setting yourself up for one.
So this is actually interesting because I was having my Botox a few weeks ago, and I'm 32, so I feel
young, you know, very young. You're still in the very young group for Botox.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Well, there was a girl in there, and she was 25, and her mum was there for Botox, and and this girl was saying that she wanted to get it done, but her mum was like, oh, I'm too young. So I'm going to admit this right now.
Yep.
I did start getting Botox when I was like 27
for
prevention.
Yeah.
So is that not a thing then?
I mean, it's not, to be honest, it's not a thing. Really, you're delaying the inevitable, okay? Or you are speeding up
the inevitable.
at the end of the day, you know, life is going to happen. It's going to catch up. Age is a fact of life. And so
But also, yeah. like, with lines, so I have a very strong, all the Allens yeah. do, very strong brow frown, yep. naturally, probably yep. because I'm, like, always squinting or trying to, like, you know, or just because I'm always fuming yeah. about something. But, like, so that's why I got that done originally, because I was getting, like, a dynamic, not even a dynamic yep. line. It was yep. there anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's probably the only place where you might get me doing preventative Botox mm. okay, as a you know, properly trained surgeon, mm. et cetera, et cetera. Because I think it does work. You know, when you have repeated Botox, and I know lots of people who've had this, the muscle gets weaker.
Mm.
And once it gets weaker, it then, like anything, if you don't exercise a muscle, it gets weaker, and then it's much, much harder to train it back up again to get going again. Same thing with your frown muscles. There are two particular muscles that cause frowning. If you do paralyze those over and over and over again, they don't get trained back up again. And your brain also forgets that they're there because
it
actually probably has a vaguely good effect for the frown lines.
Okay.
Forehead, be really careful.
Crow's what about eyes, your DAO?
Be careful.
Oh, shit. Yeah,
again, you know,
so your DAO, anyone that doesn't know what it is, it's like if you do the sad face and you pull the sides yeah. of your mouth down, yeah. it's those muscles there. But I feel like that's genetically, yeah. like that's something that if you look across the women in my family, that yeah. is a prominent thing.
I've got that, you know, why the sad face? Why yeah. You know, people. Now, you could, it's possible, the trouble is you've got to get DAO done by someone who really knows what they're doing mm. because you've got a really important nerve there that actually helps you smile and helps, you know, move your lips, helps you purse your lips, whistle. If that gets paralyzed, then your whole mouth can end up being paralyzed and you start drooling and dribbling.
No.
And that does happen. We see that.
Can you reverse Botox?
No.
Shit.
No. So you have to. But generally speaking, where it's gone off and migrated and had a slightly unwanted effect, it does tend to wear off a bit quicker than where you actually have put most of it into. Because the bit that's kind of vaguely seeped across somewhere where you don't want it, there isn't very much, and it tends to. So ptosis is the classic one. If you end up getting an eyelid droop after Botox, it's a nightmare for the first couple of weeks, but it tends to get better pretty quickly.
I remember the first time I had Botox in my forehead, I actually had the opposite effect. I remember it took place, and I was slightly hungover on a train, and I looked in the mirror, and my eyebrows were like so high,
yeah.
and I was like, oh my God, am I that hungover, or is this actually happening? And they were so high. I mean, I wish that was like that now, because I have got, I think I'm eventually going to have my eyelids done, but I would prefer them to be higher than lower.
Yeah, but also having baby Botox probably means that you're going to end up needing surgery to lift your eyebrows up
okay.
sooner than if you hadn't had baby Botox.
Can you do that for me? Can I come for you?
Yes, absolutely. Like, yeah, that is a brow lift. That's a surgical brow lift, which we do with facelifts, with neck lifts, you know, down at Battersea. Well, yeah, that's one of our bread and butter things that we do.
Is it?
Yeah. And they're getting more and more and more popular, possibly because more and more people are focusing on their faces, younger and younger and younger.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. So what would you, if someone came to you, mm-hmm. what would be the youngest person that you would give baby Botox to?
Mid-30s, that's me. I'm probably a grumpy old man, and I'm trying to be a little bit sensible. You know, I've got a 19-year-old daughter, almost 19. I would be so, you know, annoyed with her if she went off and had Botox at 25 or whatever you said that.
27.
Yeah. I just, you know what, wait, because I know what it's going to do by the time you get to 50. And then why do you want to put yourself through the risk of having surgery, et cetera, if you didn't really need it? Don't have surgery unless you really, really feel like you need it. And you think it's going to be worth all the you know, downsides, yeah. as you know, as well as the cost and the risks and the time out and all
I
that.
I saw a girl, I'm not going to mention her names, but she's 30, maybe 32, yeah. I think, same as me, and she had a full facelift.
Yeah.
And she said, and she did say, they took they managed to get 4 centimetres off her face, which is shocking, right? Like, where the hell did they get it from?
Again, got to be careful. There's facelifts and there's facelifts. So the kind of facelift that someone like me would do is what you probably are reading about now. Karen Millen was in the news yesterday.
Okay.
She's had a full-on proper facelift. Looks amazing, actually. There's before afters in the paper if you Google her. But she has probably had a proper facelift. It's not just about the skin. That's very 1980s, Nancy Reagan, just the lunchtime tuck. Yeah, it's not your skin that stretches and droops. It's the muscles, everything.
The fattier, everything.
Yeah, everything has dropped. So if you're going to get a facelift, you've got to get it done properly. Yes, people are getting it done earlier and earlier. That's also questionable. Mid-30s is probably the youngest again that I'd probably do a facelift, because that's when you can see the changes or you can see what people are born with and they could do with having that corrected, you know, heavy necks, slightly downturned mouths and, you know.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Like, and but for me, with something like a facelift, I've had my DAO done, which I loved, and it really did, like, make... I could see a difference, and it was amazing. But, like, once again, like, the neck thing runs in my the family, and that would be something that I think eventually I would want to get done. But I'd want to leave it as long as possible.
Well, actually, don't, you see, because that's the problem. Again, you know, I would say that. Okay, I'm trying to sell you surgery. But so you got to be careful there as well, because that's what people like me are trying to do. It's a business, after all. You know, I make money from this. But you don't want to have surgery too soon. But at the same time, you don't want to leave it too long. So there's this sweet spot.
Non-reversible. Okay.
No, it's just once you get, as you get older and older, your tissue quality goes down. Mm. So your healing ability, the value for money you get from surgery goes down. So that's one of the reasons why we are doing facelifts much, much more often in people in their 40s, whereas it used to be a 50s, 60s plus thing. Mm. Whereas now we know that the quality of your tissue is that much better, and you're just going to get much better value for money and a longer lasting result. Yes, you may end up needing it doing again in life. Again, later in life.
Yeah.
But actually, that might be much longer. So the proper deep plane faces and necks combined with brows and combined with things like Botox, a bit of filler, a bit of fat transfer, all those things, it's not just going off and buying a decent jacket. You've got to get the whole outfit right.
Yeah.
It's a whole...
They all work together.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can't just correct with one thing. And one of the problems is, you know, when you go to someone, when all they've got is a hammer, which is what a lot of Botox and filler people, beauticians, you know, those kind of clinics are, everything becomes a nail, and they think they can treat everything with just one treatment. Whereas you want to go to someone who does it all. And the great thing about our clinic is I don't do Botox, by the way, really. I've got other people that do it. I don't do fillers or laser.
You just do the big
but
things.
I do the surgery because I'm a surgeon. I like to cut and stitch. But I have people in the clinic under the same roof that will do that for you. And we all work together. We talk to each other. We make a plan. And you can get everything done at the right time by the right people.
So, like, you take a 360 approach to it.
Exactly, yeah. It is holistic. It's got to be.
Yeah, 100%. So if I was to come to you and say, can I have a neck lift, what would you say?
I'd say wait a little bit. You're in your 30s. Yeah. You are young. And to be honest, I've been sat here looking at you, for 10 minutes now? And I didn't notice your neck.
Thanks, mate.
So there you go. So it's also...
It's in my head.
It's quite possible you're treating it for you and actually be a bit realistic about how you look to the rest of the world. And that's one of the problems that we have, is that we're being
constantly
compared. Whole load of stuff that,
I think what I find is that social media and like filters and stuff like that has such an impact, because you see yourself with a filter and you're like, wow. And then without the filter, and you're like, shit, do I need all my work done to get like that?
And half the time you don't. Half the time it is you and your perception of yourself. And that's probably what needs to change.
Yeah.
And yes, people like me can help you, you know, tighten your neck up, lift your face.
But it's like comes from within yourself.
It's got to be, at the end of the day, what you want. It's your body, your choice. Okay, so don't end up doing something just because I told you to and my Instagram told you to. Because, you know, as I said, I'm trying to make money out of you. So it's in my interest it's in my interest to make you feel bad, isn't it? Okay, you know, come on, buy a new car, because this car, you know, and your car's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
But they're still trying to flog you a new one. That's
of
what
course.
People are
so marketing, baby.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So be careful. It is a business, but at the same time, it's got to be ethical. It's got to be safe. It's got to be balanced. It's got to be done by people who know what they're doing. Qualified, you know, properly trained for a long time. I've been doing this now for 15 years as a consultant. I became a doctor in 1995, probably before you were born. But, you know, I have been doing it for a long time, and that's the kind of person you want if you're getting anything done. You want to get
100%.
Yeah.
And I think, like, on that note, I can't get my words out. What's your Instagram again? The Real Plastic.
Real Plastics.
Real Plastics. Real Plastics. Amazing. Thank you so much for coming in. I'm definitely going to come and see you around the corner from me, so I'll be seeing you very soon.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming in. What a legend. So, guys, that is Naveen Kaval from the Real Plastics on Instagram, so check them out. We're going to talk about something that's not to do with your face right now, though. We're going to talk about my favourite shoulder exercise, the Arnold Press. So I was actually filming some exercises last week and for my app Transformation, in case anyone's interested. And the guy that was filming me, I was like, oh, we're going to do the Arnold Press now. And he goes, oh, would you program that, though? And I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, that's like a proper, you know, a proper bodybuilder move. And I was like, yes, mate, I would program that. I've used that across my programs for years. It is my favourite shoulder exercise. And of course it's a bodybuilder exercise. It's named after Arnold Schwarzenegger. So what is the Arnold Press then? It is a shoulder exercise that primarily, can't say that word, but you know what I mean, works the deltoids, triceps and trapezius muscles. But it's the only exercise, or one of the only exercises, that uses all three heads of the deltoid. So the primary muscle of the shoulder, which is the delt, has three heads. It's got the anterior, which is the front, the lateral, which is the outer, and the posterior, which is the rear. And the Arnold Press activates all three of those. How you do it? You tuck it underneath your chin, you bring it out to the side, you press it up overhead. But listen, there's loads of videos over there on YouTube of the Arnold Press. So go and check it out and add it into your upper body workout this week. Coming up after this short break, I'll be joined by Charlotte Henshaw, NBA Paralympian, who won two gold medals at this year's Olympics in Paris. I'll see you then.
FUBAR Radio. Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
What's going on in the DMs? Are you getting naughty pictures from fans? Girls, are you getting the odd little pic? I bet they're popping the DMs.
Yeah, the DMs are doing all right. Got a lot of cousins, big family, so they're all touching base.
Yeah.
There's a few girls in there as well. I've had some free videos come through.
Oh, so, tell us a little bit more. PG.
You want to go there?
Yeah, we're going there. Access all areas, mate.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way. From this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
Politics Uncensored.
I felt like it was a little bit, they wanted to go viral. They wanted the clip to end up on socials and be able to go viral, and there was nothing substantive on it. So to be honest, it kind of pissed me off because I thought it was a throwaway comment made for social media as opposed to actually giving voters information they need when they enter the voting booth.
Totally agree. And I also found the whole, I think he said something about Keir Starmer's strings being pulled by senior members of the Labour Party. I found that slightly conspiratorial.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
What's kind of that one golden thing that you like to share with people who are trying to start a business?
That's a really easy one, because I have a mantra which, you know, I say to young people all the time, and they really get it when I say it. And it goes like, don't undermine who you are by comparing yourself with someone else. It's because we are all different. Why each of us is special.
Keeping fitness fun. What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Hello, hello, hello. We are back and I'm joined by the incredible Charlotte Henshaw, MP Paralympian, who won two gold medals at Paris 2024. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on. Aren't you amazing? What the hell?
Oh.
Well, I like to keep myself busy and out of mischief. So, yeah, canoeing certainly does that.
You don't bloody say. Okay, so before we get into the nitty-gritty, I want the audience to get to know you a little bit better, okay? So I'm going to ask you some quick-fire questions, and the aim is to just answer them as quick as you can. Yeah?
Okay.
So, three words to describe yourself.
Driven, musical theatre-y, and I think I'm fun, I think.
Musical theatre-y?
Yeah, I mean, not doing it, but I love it. I should have just used musical theatre geek as my free word. But yeah, I love to go and watch. It's a good escape for me.
I love that. Okay, yeah. Workout in the morning or evening?
Morning.
Morning, same. What is your go-to cheat meal?
Oh my goodness. Anything. I just love food. But I try not to see stuff as cheat meals. So
Fair. That's fair.
Yeah.
And who is your dream workout partner?
Oh, somebody like The Rock. I love The Rock. But I've always loved him. So yeah, probably him.
Do you know how many people...
in paradise would be like a dream for me.
Yeah, I mean, same. So many people have said him. It's actually funny. I think that's like... Yeah. Next time I ask someone, I'm going to be like, apart from The Rock, who is your favourite... Yeah. Okay, my love. So how does it feel to be called a three-time Paralympic champion?
It's pretty mad, to be honest. Like, it's a dream I'd had since I was like 10 years old and I met a Paralympic champion. And that was in the days, like, I was born in 87. So this is like the mid to late 90s, where I don't think Paralympics got as much attention as it does now. So meeting somebody that had a disability and that was involved in sport was a massive inspiration for me, because I didn't see people on TV. There was obviously no such thing as social media then. So meeting her really set that tone for me, and so to do it in Tokyo was incredible. Obviously no one was there, so to do it twice in Paris when I could have people supporting me was just, you know, dream come true, and potentially is like the pinnacle of my career. I don't know, I hope it's not, but you know, if it is, then it's a pretty cool thing to have experienced.
I mean, yeah, two times in one go, like, it's actually crazy.
And within 24 hours it was wild.
No, literally, you must have been sleeping very well. We need to know your sleeping routine.
I mean, I didn't, but I knew that going in, that like I was going to be racing the Saturday late morning and then trying to do it again on the Sunday, similar sort of time. So I'd kind of set myself up that I wasn't going to stress if I didn't sleep on that Saturday night, because like one bad night's sleep probably wasn't going to affect me that much.
Yeah.
So I tried to not worry about that, because, you know, I'm one of those people that keeps looking at the clock going, I should be asleep now.
Yeah, same.
And then, you know, you keep getting into that cycle and then you don't sleep anyway. So
it's the worst. You just have to lie there. Yeah. And like, I actually, last night I had a bad night's sleep and I was actually lying there being like, one sheep or two sheep? I was just like thinking about it. Anyway.
Yeah. And I had a roommate as well who was racing the next day. So I was like, I don't want to keep her up. So I literally just laid there in the dark, just like a zombie, like, staring at the ceiling.
Just well, mate, you smash it anyway on adrenaline and vibe. So good for you.
Yeah, that's it.
How amazing is it though that you did the Tokyo and there was nobody there? And then like, that is literally it. Adrenaline and vibes. You didn't even need the audience. You just got it done.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, having, you know, reflected these last couple of weeks on both experiences, I couldn't have felt more different, like, mentally in Paris than I did in Tokyo. And I think part of that is that, like, I'd always wanted to be Paralympic champion. I'd always just missed out. I missed out in London by 0.03 seconds.
No.
I literally couldn't have been any closer.
Oh, my God.
And so to finally do it, like, and to know that I could potentially do it, it just felt like this huge weight on my shoulders. Mm. And so the initial feeling was like relief.
Yeah.
Whereas in Paris, the initial feeling was like
elation,
joy and happiness, which is so totally different.
Yeah, yeah, of course. So you transitioned from swimming to para canoeing, didn't you? So what motivated you to switch sports? Like, how amazing is that?
I think obviously there have been a lot of athletes before me that had switched out of swimming, going to different sports. Sarah Story and Jodie Cundy and all of that lot kind of paved that way. But to be honest, I'd just fallen out of love with the pool. Thankfully, I've refound that joy, like having it as being part of my canoeing training. But I'd fallen out of love with the sport and I just wanted a new challenge. Mm. And I knew that canoeing were kind of looking to build their squad, and they were local to me in Nottinghamshire. So it just felt like the right time to go and try something new. I had no idea if I'd be any good at it. I just knew that I'd feel confident enough in the water if I fell in.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all I felt.
Had you grown up then, swimming was like obviously your main sport, and I suppose like it's the same. I used to dance. I mean, I'm not a champion like you, but you know, you do when you've been doing it for so many years, like it becomes more of a chore rather than getting the enjoyment out of it.
Absolutely. I started swimming when I was like four, because at the time it was the only thing that was kind of available to a young disabled girl. And so my mum wanted me to be active and she wanted to be safe in the water. So I kind of almost like fell into swimming kind of. But I'd done it for so long. I was nearly 30 when I retired, and it had taken over my life to the point that obviously it was my career. But I just found myself like dragging myself to the pool every day. I didn't feel, and you will know from being like people that work out, you don't always feel like going.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like it was every time that I was worried about it, but it was an overarching feeling that I just didn't feel like it was giving me what I needed anymore, which is when I knew I needed to kind of move away.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it was possibly
one
of the best decision you've ever made. So let's talk about your training then. I'm so intrigued by this. Yeah. Training at such an elite level must take, like, as you said, going to that pool every day. Like, some days you couldn't be asked. But how do you get so dedicated? Like, can you talk us through what a typical week looks like for you?
Yeah, so now I'm in canoeing. It's very different in the winter for the summer. Being an outdoor sport, the winter we're predominantly like gym based. So we do 5 gym sessions a week. A lot of upper body strength, as you would imagine. So a typical week is in the winter, Monday it'd be gym and then a paddle in the afternoon, maybe a bit of like Pilates in the middle of the day. It's usually double sessions every day, apart from now I've gotten a bit older, I need to be a bit smarter about my training. So I have a day in the week where I don't go into the training center, but I go for a swim at my local pool just to kind of get some low level aerobic work in, stretch out, you know, just basically for recovery, I guess. And then sort of combine that with about 3 or 4 paddling sessions, which lasts like an hour. And then in the summer, we kind of flip that round and we're on the water 5-6 times a week, in the gym 3 times a week. We do Pilates, we do reformer. And then obviously all the things in between, like lying on the physio bed for like what feels like 5,000 hours, because I always need physio.
So
it's not just the training as well. It's like every decision that I make in my entire life is, you know, that I factor in how it will affect my training, whether that's a late night or travel. Sitting in a car is like horrendous for obviously posture and movement, and so all of my decisions are geared around my sport. So it does take over your entire life, but that's, you know, that's the part of the trade-off of being able to do sport for a living, you know. That's what you have to kind of work with, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose like everything, you know, even from what you eat, like as you said, your sleep, like your social life, everything has to kind of contribute to the overall goal.
Absolutely. And that's cool, you know. That's what I love, and that's what I signed up for. And it, you know, when you get to go to these big competitions, and that's the trade-off, and I'm happy with that for now.
So when you know, you said before that you had a different feeling after the Tokyo compared to Paris. How do you prepare yourself mentally for the competitions? Was it different for both of those events as well, or how do you prepare yourself for these amazing things?
Yeah, I mean, I find it really tricky. In swimming, I was never like the out and out, if you can ever be a favourite in sport, because that's the beauty of sport, you can't predict. But I have won every major championship in canoeing since 2018. And so I think my brain has taken on this kind of weight of expectation of what I think other people expect of me. And I am also, like, I expect a lot of myself. And so I think that that can get to the point where it becomes a negative thing. Like, I was starting to become frightened of losing because of what everyone else would think. And so literally 8 weeks out from the Paris Games, I started working with a brand new psychologist, just to kind of offload all of these feelings to her. And she massively helped me going into Paris to try and see it as like an opportunity, you know. Like, I put the work in, I've worked as hard as I possibly can. Why was I scared of the result? And, you know, she really kind of brought it home to me when she said, like, what is the worst that could happen? You could lose a race. Like, will you never get over that? And when I really, like, thought about that, I was like, well, of course it will feel crap and I'll hate it. but it's not something that I'll never get over. And so why am I building it up enormous thing? And so that massively freed me up. When I went to Paris, I was like, I was excited to race, to kind of showcase what I'd been working on. And if it was good enough to win a gold, then even better. But I was confident in my prep and my ability, and I was just excited to go out and do it. And that was a huge game changer for me. And I'm hoping that I'm going to keep that moving forward over the next 4 years towards LA.
100%. And I think that was going to go on to my next question then. You know, as you said, it makes me laugh because you say it, when I retired from obviously doing the swimming and you were only 30. I'm like, so crazy when you are in such high level sport. You have to retire at such a young age. But if you, so when you do retire from, you know, whatever you're doing, hopefully that's not for some years, I would assume that you're probably going to take your expertise and help younger people become as fabulous as you are. And so what would you then advise those young athletes who dream of reaching the top like you, especially those that may face challenges like disabilities?
I think for young, certainly disabled kids, but it's not exclusive to disability, anybody that's got a barrier in place, I guess, from allowing them to follow whatever dream it is that they have, is like to use the people around you. Like, I didn't do this on my own. Like, when I was younger, it was other people asking the questions for me. It was other people fighting my battles. Now I'm older and I can ask those questions myself. Unfortunately, as a disabled person who wants to get involved in athletics or even physical exercise, not even competitive sport, you often have to ask more questions than a non-disabled person to make sure that you are catered for and welcomed. And I would encourage people to surround yourself with people that will help you take on that fight. And then, you know, as you move forward throughout your career and in sport, you know, it's collaborative. I'm the one that's on the start line, but I'm not doing it by myself. And I can't be so proud to think that I don't need anybody's help to do that. And so I'd encourage people to communicate and collaborate, because that's the key to a successful athletic career, probably any career. So yeah, that'd be my biggest piece of advice for sure.
Yeah, I love that, because it's like, you know, yes, you can be as best as you can be, but then you might just need that support from, well, obviously nutritionist, your trainer, you said that your mum was the person that basically threw you in the pool, you know, like she was the one that made you do all of this stuff. And I think if you have, it's the same with anything, if you have that support system around you, it's going to give you the confidence and, you know, to even just get there in the first place, because you can do anything that you set your mind to, right?
Absolutely. You absolutely can. And also, on the flip side, is surround yourself with people that also don't have anything to do with the world that you're in, so that you get perspective. Like, I'm still friends with my school friends. Like, we've been friends since we were 11. And they don't, obviously they're incredibly proud of what I've done. They were out in Paris supporting me, but at the end of the day, like, that's not the only reason that we are friends, and our friendship isn't built around sport. And so it gives me that kind of removal from that high pressured world, that I can go to coffee with them, or we can go for a dinner. And it's not about that. It gives me that really valuable perspective that there is more to life than your career and what you are working towards every day. And that certainly helps me when things get a bit pressured. I kind of just call them up and go, can we just go out and talk about our time at school or like kids? And, you know, it's hugely important to have people that have like all expertise and walks of life around you, because it does give you that perspective for sure.
And it's also probably contributes to, as you, when you said earlier, when you were talking to your psychotherapist about, you know, not winning, it's not going to be a life or death situation, and your normal friends will like can completely appreciate, like, someone looking at me, even if you just competed in these games and not even won, I still think you are incredible. You know what I mean? What you've been through, what you've done to get to where you are is amazing. So it, yes, okay, getting the medal is, you know, that's the goal, like, essentially, but you're still doing amazing things. I'm really, you know, you're really working at your craft every single day and like trying to be the best you can be, and that is so admirable for anyone looking on.
Absolutely. And that's the important thing that I stress to people, is like the route to success is never straightforward. It's never up, up, up all the time. There's going to be those peaks and troughs. And, you need those people around you that are invested in you as a person rather than the goal that you're trying to achieve.
Exactly.
To kind of help you navigate those. It's so important. And as I've got older, I've realized how important that is, just to be able to switch off from the athlete, Charlotte, just to be me. And like, that's what I was saying about musicals, you know, it provides yeah. huge, like, I can't think about canoeing when I'm immersed in this world that yeah. is totally out of, you know, anything that's usual. And that's what my brain needs to kind of switch off. And it's so important.
I love that. Well, I think you are amazing. And hopefully you are going to go on to continue this winning trend in the next Paralympics.
I hope so. LA is very tempting. I was almost like, do I retire? And then when they said it's going to LA, I was like, oh no.
One more won't
That's
hurt.
Tempting. I want to be there.
Yeah, definitely. Well, good luck with everything. And hopefully we'll get you back on once you've won some more gold after that time.
Well, that'd be nice. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for coming on today. You are fabulous. Speak to you soon. Wow, what a woman. Coming up after this, I'm going to be joined by Adele Johnston, menopause coach. I'll see you then, my loves.
Foobar Radio. Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
What's going on in the DMs? Are you getting naughty pictures from fans? Girls, are you getting the odd little pic? I bet they're popping the DMs.
Yeah, the DMs are doing all right. Got a lot of cousins, big family, so they're all touching base.
Yeah.
There's a few girls in there as well. I've had some fruity videos come through.
Oh, so, tell us a little bit more.
You go there?
Yeah, we're going there. Access all areas, mate.
You're listening to Foobar Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Foobar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for Foobar Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The Foobar Radio app. Get it today.
One in five people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
Politics Uncensored.
I felt like it was a little bit, they wanted to go viral. They wanted the clip to end up on socials and be able to go viral, and there was nothing substantive on it. So to be honest, it kind of pissed me off because I thought it was a throwaway comment made for social media as opposed to actually giving voters information they need when they enter the voting booth.
Totally agree. And I also found the whole, I think you said something about Keir Starmer's strings being pulled by senior members of the Labour Party. I found that slightly conspiratorial.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
What's kind of that one golden thing that you like to share with people who are trying to start a business?
That's a really easy one, because I have a mantra which, you know, I say to young people all the time, and they really get it when I say it. And it goes like, don't undermine who you are by comparing yourself with someone else. It's because we are all different. Why each of us is special.
Follow us at What The Health Show for more from Gabby. This is What The Health.
Hello, and we are back for a moment of wellness with Adele Johnston, menopause coach. Are you there, my gorgeous lady?
I am here. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on today's show. I'm so excited to have this conversation because I feel like it's so, so much more talked about than it used to be. All things yeah. menopause.
It sure is. And I love that about it now.
Yeah, so good. So you have a campaign to make menopause mainstream. Can you talk me through this?
Yes. So Make Menopause Mainstream was Well, maybe take you back to the beginning. I was in my early 30s when I entered into early menopause, and I didn't know that that's what it was. So at 33, I just wasn't feeling too great, and put it down to the stresses and strains of modern life, having kids, corporate career, all the things. And it wasn't until I was 37 that I had all of the medical teams agree with me that I'd gone into early menopause or premature ovarian insufficiency. And it was one of those horrendous things, Gabby, when you then check on Google and you're like, right, what does this mean? And I just didn't recognize myself in any of the images that were portrayed. It was, you know, with the most love, very old women that were being portrayed on there. And I thought, look, I'm not old. I don't feel
no,
old.
No, you still look amazing. You look so young.
Yeah, and I wasn't ready to give things up, right? I wasn't ready to think, right, I just have to not wear jeans again because they hurt me when I wear them and I don't...
Can I just pull it back here? What were the symptoms that you felt at 33 when you went into that perimenopausal state?
Yeah. So the first things that I noticed, I don't actually get a bleed because I have the Mirena coil, so I don't get a bleed. So it wasn't that there were any changes to my menstrual cycle or periods. It was actually that I started to get really forgetful. I was doing the really silly things that people laugh at, like putting the remote control inside the fridge. just thought I was really super tired, right? I wasn't sleeping. I had clumps of hair coming out when I'd wash my hair in the shower. I lost the ability to, like, when I was driving late at night, I couldn't see properly, so my eyesight changed.
Is there any reason that, like, this could be, sorry if this is a really ignorant question, but is there anything that can trigger it happening, or is it just literally genetics? Or...
We don't know. So we can't even prove that it's anything to do with genetics. My mum was about 55, 56 when she went through her menopause. So she was classed as being normal, if there's such a thing. So she went through menopause at the normal age range. I have a bit of a theory around it, and we can't prove that this is the truth. I competed in bikini level bodybuilding for 2 years. And
your hormones.
Yes.
Yeah.
And when we think about it in that sense, I was so dieted, probably had amenorrhea where your periods stop. I didn't give my body that break in terms of giving the ability for hormones to recover. So my theory behind it all, and this was covered on a lot of big news channels, was that I actually potentially caused some irreversible damage to my endocrine and my hormones. Mm.
That is actually wild and not surprising, though. Like, I have considered doing competitions myself just because I would like to challenge my body to be able to do that. And I think also as a trainer, it gives you kind of the, you know, it makes you, gives you a bit of integrity almost, like, to be able to get to that, you know, into that amazing form. However, the main reason that I haven't done it is because mainly the food is the situation, to be honest, but also because of the damage that it has on your hormones anyway. And I've I'm still figuring out if I have PCOS or whatever, but basically my hormones haven't been as stable as some other people. So I'm like, I can't mess with that shit because if I end up like making it? Yeah. What if I go back to not having periods because of?
Yeah, exactly. Do you know, I think it comes way back, right? I'm of a generation, so I'm 41 now, and I'm of a generation that didn't get explained around menstrual cycles, tracking your symptoms, how important estrogen or estradiol is for the female body. I went on the contraceptive pill at 15 and I didn't come off it until I wanted to get pregnant with my twins. And then I went back on contraception again. So I've never really allowed my body to have a natural menstrual cycle. Mm. Does that play a role? I can't say yes or no. My kind of theory behind it all is yes, because we need to have these beautiful surges of hormones each month, and I stopped my body from having them.
Yeah, it's funny though, because when I went to see the gynecologist that I went to see, he told me straight up, he was like, the pill does not affect anything like that. He was like, if you are with somebody that you want to have babies with, which I wasn't, but he was like, you could come off the pill. And yeah, obviously it might take some people longer than others to regulate their their cycle, but he was like, the pill doesn't, I don't know, like, are they trained to say that? We need to get somebody on this show that can figure that out for us.
Absolutely. I am mentored by two doctors. One of them is private, one of them is NHS. And the conversations that I've had with both of them around just women's health in general, a GP, a doctor within general practice, will have around 10 years of education. And out of those 10 years, they will have around 2 hours of training on women's health, predominantly on how to prescribe the contraceptive pill or devices or preparation. So it's not that anybody's trained to say that. I just honestly believe that there's not enough research or education within women's health to know differently.
Yeah. It's just so sad, isn't it? Like,
yeah, what they... it really, really is. And that, you know, coming back to your original question on why menopause, making menopause mainstream,
yeah,
it's because the more that we do this, the more that we talk about it, the more that we get people saying, well, actually, I've had those symptoms and I'm only in my 30s. My massive outcome from all of this will be that we get medical teams and professionals and specialists to agree that actually I'm not an early perimenopause or menopause, that perimenopause, that stage before menopause, does actually begin in your 30s. But women are not known to know that. We're not educated on it. We're not expressed enough around it. So we fumble around for potentially 10 years feeling really horrendous before we eventually hit our 40s and the doctor's like, yeah, it's menopause.
Yeah, but even on that, like, my mom is, sorry, mom, to tell everyone, but she's menopausal and she doesn't know how to navigate it. She's like using the internet to like research and be like, one minute she's like, fasting helps. Next minute she's like, fasting doesn't help. You know, there's so much information out there, you know, which is great, but then at the same time nobody knows what is accurate and what's not accurate. And I also think with female health, I believe that we should be taught about this stuff in school, like, and up until, you know, maybe not when you can actually digest it, like maybe when we're starting our periods, and, you know, maybe in the later part of senior school, we should just be, even if it's not like a big in-depth conversation, I do believe that we should be, you know, sort of nurtured to know how to approach our adult life, because, you know, periods alone can be quite, you know, everybody has the same kind of period, I get that. But if we kind of given just some sort of insight to what to expect, so that we're not going into this blind like everybody is, you know, I know we all get older, but we all still feel young and inside, regardless of whether gravity and all that's taken over. But your body's doing all this mad stuff and we don't know what to do about it.
Yeah, agreed. I completely agree. We do have, so I'm down in Parliament next month, and there's lots of debates and conversations that are happening around how we get more mainstream awareness, education, knowledge. 80% of people, women in particular now, are using social media for their menopause guidance. Mm-hmm. So that's why people like me who are evidence-based, you know, I'm mentored by two medical doctors. So it's finding the right type of knowledge and information, because like anything, there's a whole pile of rubbish out there as well that unfortunately is more harmful than good. And I have the Menopause Coach podcast that people can also follow along every single week with an evidence-based episode that's 30 minutes long.
Amazing.
So it's finding things and platforms like that that you can trust and rely on to share that knowledge. And that's what making menopause mainstream is about, sharing bite-sized knowledge in really easy to digest terms.
Okay, that's a podcast, did you say? What's it called?
The Menopause Coach,
and that's the same as your Instagram as well, the dot menopause coach, for anyone that wants to drop you a little follow there. So what do you make of women using testosterone to manage their symptoms? Is that a thing?
It is a thing, and it's a thing I do, so I can talk about it from a personal perspective.
Yeah,
as well.
Go on.
So for me, a lot of my symptoms were due to low-level androgens, and that happens to women. As much as we associate testosterone as being a male hormone, it is a female hormone as well. The ovaries produce this, so we've got to remember that. This is not a male-based hormone if we look at it in that form. When I started replacing TRT, so testosterone replacement therapy, it's a gel that you just rub onto your leg. So tiny little pea size every morning. It's very like non-invasive. It doesn't smell. It's just in a little sachet, and I pop it on the top of my thigh every morning. And I went from being someone that my quote menopause support doctor said, I don't know how you're even functioning, to waking up within 6 weeks of starting testosterone therapy and thinking, holy effing H, this is what it feels like to have a bit of cognitive sharpness, energy, my libido back, a really good, healthy sex life, enjoying being energized and actually being able to really lift well in the gym when I'd trained like a bodybuilder for years before and had never grown what we refer to as those androgen-rich muscle groups. So the deltoids, the quadriceps, I never ever built them. So I still look very scrawny.
And that was all due to low testosterone levels?
Low testosterone, yeah, absolutely. My levels were so, so low that the tests were reran and reran because they thought that they were a laboratory error.
Wow. So would you recommend ladies going through the menopause to have all their bloods done to then see what they're lacking to then help with replacing
them? This is a really controversial one because within the NHS and the NICE guidelines, it will state that if you are 45 and over, then no bloods need to be ran because they can pretty much say, based on symptoms alone, we can confirm that because of your age, because of the symptoms, that you are in menopause. Under the age of 45, then blood works are ran to check for things like thyroid. So we want to make sure that there's not another endocrine or thyroid or hormone-based challenge. What I say, however, and I do this with all of my ladies that I work with, is we like to understand where the levels are currently sitting. Because you may have beautiful levels of estradiol, progesterone we don't tend to really check, but if your testosterone levels are sitting significantly low, then that can also be why you're experiencing a lot of these cognitive mood, unfortunately, testosterone is seen to be that libido-based hormone and it isn't just
It's funny how you explained it is actually so accurate. Testosterone's linked, you know, you just think about big bodybuilders in the gym, whereas it is actually something that a female produces as well.
Absolutely. Yeah,
and I also think that the blood thing is kind of frustrating too, because blood can show so much. When I had my bloods taken, my prolactin levels were like, nearly in the thousands, and that what was causing my amenorrhea. Nothing else, not testosterone, nothing like that. And that's produced in the pituitary gland in my head. How you can show so much from bloods, and it's just classic, you know, cutting corners because they just don't, maybe just they just don't have the manpower. But if you can go and get your bloods done,
it's all things, right? It's, you know, if you start getting a bit controversial with it, which I love a bit of a controversial conversation, it's about, you know, lacking budget. The NHS was built by men for men. We're not seen as important enough within that space of budgetary allocation for research. So we don't actually have any research within women's health, really.
Yeah. And you see more and more talked about these days that, most studies are done on men. So when we're being told to, you know, buy this product or, you know, buy this supplement, actually, it's not actually proven to help women. It's proven to help men. So how do we know? We are not just small men. We have all these different hormones, believe it or not. So it's just, wild.
Absolutely. I know, it is wild. And again, I understand that it's a bit more complex, right? If we think of it as in these three sex hormones that we talk about for females. So estrogen, that's a plural. There's forms of estrogen. There's progesterone, there's testosterone. If we start to then try to track all of this and manage it all, it fluctuates vastly.
Yeah.
But it is obviously so difficult to do that research in, but we have to start.
Yeah. And I actually saw a guy talking about this on Instagram yesterday, talking about a women's cycle. And he actually did explain it very, very well. But I was just, he compared it to how men, you know, from week to week, their hormones don't really fluctuate that much. But that's why even training amongst our cycle now has, I do like that we are doing more and more research into this, or people are talking about it a bit more. Because, as you said, they change from day to day, not even week to week, day to bloody day.
Right. Yeah, what you wake up with in the morning is entirely different by lunchtime and into the evening. And I think that as well, like, everybody is an individual. And that's why we need to look at this as how your cycle affects your training versus your mood versus your sleep can be entirely different to another woman's. I don't use myself because I don't have a cycle. So,
Well, I'm new to the whole cycle life because it's only been like the last year that I've actually had some sort of cycle. And I'm now being able to recognize when I am going to have peaks and troughs. Like this morning, I actually am a bit more like tired and a bit like, you know, and I was like, oh, actually, I'm in the third week of my cycle. So I'm coming
very common. Yeah. Normal, very healthy. I love that you're doing this now. If I could go back, and I've got twin 14-year-old girls, and we do the whole manual tracking and they understand where they are in their cycle. If I could go back, I would love to be that 14-year-old girl understanding it now.
Well, now you do have all of the info, and you're going to be, they're going to be beaming with knowledge because of you. So thank you so much. I feel like I've learned so much from you today as well. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today, Adele. Keep doing what you're doing because you are amazing, and you look fucking amazing as well. So
thank you for having me. I've loved being here. It's brilliant. Anytime.
Thank you, Gorge. Speak to you soon. Have a great day.
Bye.
Guys, what a chat. I will see you next week for another What the Health show. Lots of love. Goodbye.